From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. On July 1st, Vermont author Eric Zencey died in his home in Montpelier. His obituary in the Times Argus called him a professor, writer, and social critic, and a tireless evangelist for a new way of thinking about humankind's relationship with nature. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview from 2014 with Eric Zencey. The following bio is excerpted from his Times Argus obituary. Eric Zencey arrived in Vermont in 1980 to teach at Goddard College and quickly developed a deep love for his adopted state. It was at Goddard where he met his wife, the author Catherine Davis, and where they were married, building a life together and raising their daughter, Daphne. While his writing focused for the most part on the subject of ecological sustainability, he was also the author of the best-selling 1995 novel, Panama, in which Henry Adams, the subject of his PhD dissertation at Claremont Graduate College, turns detective. In addition to Panama, Eric published three works of nonfiction: Virgin Forest, Meditations on History, Ecology, and Culture; The Other Road to Serfdom and the Path to Sustainable Democracy; and Greening Vermont, The Search for a Sustainable State, co-authored with Elizabeth Courtney. Before the final stages of prostate cancer debilitated him, Eric was finishing work on an essay collection, Slumlord Nation, entrusting its completion to his brother, Matt. Eric spent much of his career teaching courses that explored cross-currents among the disciplines of economics, philosophy, political science, history, and ecology. He never gave up trying to disabuse the economics profession of its assumption that a planet with billions of people is physically capable of supporting infinite economic growth. In addition to Goddard College, he taught in Empire State College's International Program as a visiting lecturer in the Sam Fox School of Architecture at Washington University in St. Louis, and in the Honors Program at the University of Vermont, where he also was a fellow at the Gund Institute. In the months before his death, he raised more than $100,000 to endow the Eric Zencey Prize in Ecological Economics to be administered by UVM's Gund Institute. When I sat with him at his kitchen table in August 2014, I began by reading a passage from the book Greening Vermont, The Search for a Sustainable State. It was just one of the books that we discussed in our conversation. And then I asked him about the quote. So you'll hear the beginning of this conversation starts with the passage from the book. I found the ensuing conversation very interesting. I hope you do too. As a matter of geography, economics, and cultural predisposition, in Vermont, the hydrocarbon revolution, that phase of the Industrial Revolution that was kicked off by the rapid drawdown of the antique solar energy stored in fossil fuels, arrived rather late in the game. With no sources of coal or oil of its own, and far from the seaports and transportation hubs through which such energy sources might have been imported in large quantities, Vermont remained, through the early days of the Age of Oil, what it had long been before, an agricultural society that subsisted on the solar and renewable energies offered by its own forests and fields and rivers. For the most part, its economy was fueled by wood for burning, fodder for draft animals, and hydropower to run its mills and machining industry. This difference in its history helped to make Vermont a place apart. I loved that. And it sounded like what Vermont lacked in industrial production actually helped to protect it. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I have come to see Vermont's history and actually the history of Western civilization in general through this lens of energy use. And I think I call it the hydrocarbon revolution there, or Elizabeth and I do. Mm-hmm. And if this had been an academic work, I should have footnoted that, because I got that idea from someone, that what we call the Industrial Revolution was actually a hydrocarbon revolution, a revolution in the energy sources that we use. And when you pan back and think in these historical terms, it's interesting to see that just a few hundred years ago, humans learned the trick of turning these fossil fuel sources, fossilized sunlight, into wealth, food, money in the present. And that's a once in the history of the planet event. Mm-hmm. And we're living through this fossil fuel age. And, you know, if you're like me, you kind of think, well, like when we were all kids, we thought our lives are normal. And only when you begin meeting other kids and other parents do you realize they do things differently. Well, we have that kind of temporal parochiality that you just sort of assume this is the normal world. And part of my job as a teacher and in writing these books was to show people, no, this is a really rare historical moment that we happen to be alive in, and it's going to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which seems to be a theme through these two books, both of these books. There's mm-hmm. just this infinite planet idea that people have that just isn't tenable.
Right. And this was something that wasn't really emphasized in the academic work I did in graduate school, where I was specifically studying kind of the history of Western political thinking, looking at what different political philosophers and philosophers had to say about nature and humans and the relationship of culture to the planet. And sometimes it was easy to categorize them as like good guys or bad guys, you know, depending on whether they seemed like they were promoting the domination of nature or sympathetic to some other way of being. And yet in none of that was it organized around that kind of notion of, it's like all of these people are treating the planet as if it were infinite. Mm-hmm. Because 200-300 years ago, there was human culture was such a small footprint that it seemed like, oh yeah, it's a minor thing. And now it's no longer so minor, and we have to start thinking there are limits.
Yeah, right. Okay. So I enjoyed reading the history as you presented in Greening Vermont. The full title is Greening Vermont, The Search for a Sustainable State. I loved the history that you present here, the various events like the establishment of the highway system that I guess they started building in 1958. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of really changed Vermont right away, right there. That was a big change. I loved all the history of these agencies like the VNRC and the VINS, VINS, and also your close examination of Act 250. It's just a very helpful book. Who's the audience for this book? Is it used as a textbook or is it?
It is being used as a textbook at Middlebury and you know, Knockwood, which I won't do too loudly. I hope it gets picked up in some other places. There's a sort of backstory to the origin of this book. Elizabeth Courtney, who was then the executive director of the Vermont Natural Resources Council, had an idea for a commemorative book, a 50-year look back at the history of the VNRC. Mm-hmm. And she had some pages, a draft that some staff people had worked on, and some ideas for the book. And she shared them with me and said, you're a writer, what do you think of this? And I read through what was there and thought, you know, this is going to be of interest pretty much only to the people who were mentioned in it or who have primary experience of the history of this organization. And it's a nice commemoration of the organization, but it's like corporate history.
Right.
And I said to her, you know, you could tell this story as the history of the movement as a whole, and the VNRC has been in an important player in that, but the movement was larger than the VNRC, and the story should be told by focusing on the problems that the VNRC and other organizations dealt with. The way the draft was written, it kind of was driven by the organizational perspective. And then we moved our offices to such and such.
Yeah.
And then the budget increased. And then we had to lay off staff. So, and you know, that's fine for organizational history, but I encouraged her to think about the book in broader terms. And she said, well, that sounds really good. Do you want to write that book?
Yeah.
And we decided to collaborate on it. And it was a pretty equal division of responsibilities. She had lived through much of this history. I mean, she was, part of her story is in the book when she was chair of the environmental board and was, her renewal became a political issue, is mentioned in the book.
Right.
And she knew which events, which moments, which laws, which controversies the book ought to touch on. Which is an enormous thing to know when you're trying to write a 50-year history.
Because she had that political background.
Right, and she also had draft material and notes and journal entries and chapter work. And she and I would trade drafts back and forth and move them toward the book you see.
Yeah, and actually that was going to be a question I had for you. How was it collaborating with another writer on a book?
Well, it was a first for me, and I've only ever done one other collaboration, which was an article that the president of a college I was teaching at shared with me and said, "You're a writer, here, what do you think of this?" And I fixed it up so much that when I gave it back to him, I said, "You know, you should list me as a co-author." And so that was my model for co-authorship, was like somebody writes draft and I tinker it, and we're both co-authors. In a longer work, it's possible to trade those roles. It's like, oh, someone has a first draft of this chapter and the other person looks at it, tinkers it, and you discuss. And then back and forth. And sometimes those discussions were, sometimes it was very agreeable, and sometimes it was like, no, it really should be, but I insist this has to be this way. Sometimes it was me insisting, and sometimes it was Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting process, and I think the book is stronger for us both having been involved in
it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. You present each decade, the two of you, present each decade from the 60s forward with this little sidebar titled Vermont by the Numbers.
Uh-huh.
It's just this little thing, but I loved reading them. I was so into it. So in 1960, Vermont's population was 389,881, and the number of cows was 258,000. That was awesome. By the 2010s, these numbers have changed to 625,741 for the total population and 135,000 cows. The number of farms has gone down by, I don't know, 25% or something, from 9,400 to 6,984. So anyway, that was an interesting sidebar, very interesting.
Yeah, I wanted sort of the physical reality there, and, you know, that would have been a series of sentences that would have been deadly dull.
Yeah, but as it was like, oh, now I'm going to look for the sidebar again, because here we are in a new chapter.
Yeah.
So everyone knows that we don't have billboards. It's one of the great environmental truths of Vermont. And then there's an ad in here that you include in the book. I guess it was early in this campaign. Attack that pest, attack and fight, attack the growing billboard blight.
Right. Elizabeth worked with Mason Singer and the state archivist and found all these great pictures.
Yeah,
and so,
really good artwork in the book, too.
Yeah. Part of my interest in having this story is, okay, this is one of the big explanations for, you know, people come here and they say, Vermont looks so different. And some of them have to be, you have to point out to them, it's like, well, there are no billboards.
Right.
Oh, really? That's what,
yeah.
That's part of what it is. I wanted to have that story in there because that the decision that the business community came to about billboards could serve as a model for some other decisions that we have yet to make.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the model there was each of you can get a marginal advantage for a little while, maybe, if you put up a big billboard. But if you all put up big billboards, you all lose out because people will stop coming here because they won't be able to see the landscape. So there's a... it's called a kind of tragedy of the commons dynamic at work there, that individually self-motivated behavior produces a socially undesirable outcome. That logic, that statement, flies in the face of much economic theory, or at least the reigning paradigm today, which seems to be, you get to a sense of the public good by adding up individual goods. Individual selfishnesses is supposed to produce the best outcome. And the controversy over the billboard law showed that at that point, the business community accepted the logic that that's not true.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see that logic reinvigorated today.
Yeah.
About, for instance, climate change.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me, too, that the Republican Party, which I will still associate with the business community going back quite far, was much more environmentally conscious. Certainly, maybe it still is more so in Vermont than in other places, but it was very environmentally conscious back in the 80s. You tell the great story of James Watt coming to Vermont for a fundraising dinner, and basically nobody shows up because in protest to his environmental policy.
So none of the state Republican leaders wanted to be associated with Watt on that visit, and Senator is busy in Washington, and the governor is busy somewhere else, and future governor Jim Douglas, whose position I forget then, but he was in a state office, he just said flat out, I'll be at home with my family. It's like that's more important than showing up with that guy.
And
things like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, these all date to Richard Nixon's administration. So there was not a contradiction between being a Republican and being in favor of strong environmental legislation. For quite a while now, though, certainly on the national scene, the Republicans have been the party of we have to get the government off our backs, and that includes these environmental regulations that are stifling economic development.
Right. Well, and also because we're running out of oil and they want to drill, baby, drill. So
yeah.
Okay. All right, so one of the things you talk about in the book is Act 250. There are 10 criteria by which permits are judged for development under Act 250, and they've stayed pretty much consistent, as you say in the book. You know, they were issued at the start, and they're still pretty much the same. Things like no undue water or air pollution, which seems fairly straightforward. But then there's number 8 says, would not have an undue adverse effect on aesthetics, scenic beauty, historic sites, natural areas. That seems a little bit more subjective. It seems like it must be hard for them to deal with.
It's very interesting that's written in there, no undue impact on aesthetic values, including the view shed. There's a sort of classic argument that what one person thinks is beautiful, another person thinks is ugly. I can recall seeing pictures of smoke billowing from smokestacks in, you know, my third grade reader. And this was an image of beauty because it represented progress, wealth, industry. I don't know. So aesthetics is somewhat subjective. It would be interesting to talk with some of the administrators of that law, which is now adjudicated in a special environmental court. It'd be interesting to talk with them about what their criteria are for aesthetic values. I think it has to do with local community standards. People aren't presuming to prescribe, but saying, well, whatever the community accepts or writes in would be okay.
Right.
Which may or may not be a good thing, but
It's like my own community has had huge development, just huge residential development, and they've decided on a plan that they think is aesthetically pleasing, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, Wendell Berry said somewhere, I think it was Wendell Berry, who said, the more you know about nature, the more you walk in a world of wounds. And so wounds are never pretty. So the more you know about our relationship to the environment, the less you will find pretty. To some eyes, oh, that's a wonderfully beautiful development. And to others, it's like, that was deer yard and productive wetlands. Right. What happened?
That shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So who came up with the structure of the book? There are these conversations that take place within the text, you know, like there will be, within a chapter, there will be a conversation that shows local people that are involved in different environmental, and then there's also the sidebars like the one I mentioned. So how did you guys come up with the structure?
It was Elizabeth's idea to have conversations and portraits of the people who were in the conversations. And I'm sorry to say, most of them were done while I was teaching in St. Louis, so I didn't get to participate. It would have been great to meet some of these people featured in the book. Some of them I've been wanting to meet. So that was her idea, and the structure of the book to go through by decades was her idea, and it makes sense. Event circumstance in the world isn't always neatly divisible into decades, and there are some times when we pick up the narrative has to pick up a thread for a particular decade, like, oh, this story starts really 3 years before the decadal change, or it's ongoing. But it's a good convenient structure. The sidebars, some of them came from just my tendency to, like, we want to explain this. It's like, that's too much text for this chapter. Well, can we run it as a sidebar?
Yeah.
So many of the text sidebars are mine. And I think it was also my idea for the first sidebar with the data, the numbers.
Oh, the Vermont by the numbers. Yeah.
That seemed a handy way of putting some physical facts out there that you know, were easily digestible.
Yeah.
So in terms of structure, it's a mix, but I'd give the edge to Elizabeth in terms of, you know, she had a plan in mind, she had a draft.
Yeah. And yeah, it's highly readable and very attractive. And
good.
So let's talk about another book on sustainability that you wrote on your own, actually, and that one's The Other Road to Serfdom and the Path to Sustainable Democracy.
Oh, yeah.
So we did talk about this just a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about the infinite planet theory, which I think is huge in the theme of this book. So if you could just talk about a little bit more about
it. Sure. I think the coming division in American politics is not going to be so much between Republicans and Democrats, or even 1%, 99%, although that's a powerful one, red state, blue state, but it's going to be between infinite planet thinking and practice and sustainable communities. Either the idea system you're working from assumes that the planet is infinite and that we can have infinite economic growth, or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, chances are whatever you're doing is building the infrastructure, sometimes the intellectual infrastructure, we need for an ecologically sustainable society. So there's the infinite growth people and the steady staters, is another way of putting it. Economics wants to think that we can have infinite economic growth even on a finite planet because the human imagination is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book called The Infinite Resource that talks about how more people is better because more people have more imagination, and imagination is the one factor of production that we can create an infinite amount, neglecting the fact that the human imagination is encased in a body, a brain, and all thought, Lauren Isley said, burns by the power of a leaf. You have to eat to think, and the amount of food that we can cultivate from nature is finite because nature is finite. So ultimately there's some finite number of people that the planet can support. So the infinite planet thinking is wrong there, and it's also wrong to think the imagination can do anything. Because, as I tell my students, no one is ever going to successfully imagine a way around the laws of thermodynamics. And those, the book, The Other Road to Serfdom and The Path to Sustainable Democracy, is my attempt to communicate to a general audience the insights offered by a school of economic thinking that takes the laws of thermodynamics seriously.
Okay.
Now, it's always fun to ask people, do you remember the laws of thermodynamics? People, I ask students, and some of them sort of remember, but you know, it's always useful to review. The first law tells you the amount of matter and energy in the universe is constant. Neither matter nor energy can be created nor transformed, only transformed. This was very useful to chemists in looking at chemical reactions. It's like, the amount of stuff you have left over at the end has to equal the amount of stuff at the start, and the amount of energy, it either gave off energy, which is floating around, or it took in energy, you applied heat, but the amount is, you know. So that was very useful there. The second law, and we kind of get that. It seems intuitively obvious. Okay, the continuity of matter and energy, right, indestructible. The second law says, okay, the amount of energy in the universe is constant, but the amount of usable energy can only decline.
Okay.
And that's because energy, once used, is never available at that level again. There's a slow slide down from more useful to less useful. For instance, your automobile is a way of turning the potential energy, chemical energy of gasoline, into heat and motion. And of course, it's the motion that you buy the gasoline for and have the engine and want to get moving with. We will never invent a machine that can take motion and heat and turn it back into gasoline. That's just a given. I mean, it's the second law. It's a one-way flow from more useful to less useful, more dissipated. That law is the one that says, ultimately, with some intermediate reasoning and various other kinds of considerations, it's the one that says, so that means the planet, there's a finite amount of economic activity the planet can support. And from that, you can conclude the more of us there are, the lower our average enjoyment of economic well-being, wealth, will be. So it points to a world of limits, which the whole idea of environmental limits was on the table 30 years ago, has been off the table for the past 25 years, Reaganism, Morning in America. And some of us are trying to get it back into the public consciousness that some of the problems we're seeing are a result of our economy running into environmental limits.
Right.
And I can go on.
Well, and actually,
I can lecture on this. So.
Well, that relates to this quote in the book that I wanted you to explain to me.
Oh.
So, economy is a subset of ecology and not vice versa. So, this sounds like it's part of this conversation.
Yeah,
so, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, sure, sure. If you pick up a standard economics book, there'll be a section on a minor section on pollution.
Right.
And environmental values, and we'll talk about how some economists are talking about putting a price on pollution so that we would have less of it, or the optimal amount, which is the cost of the pollution would be equal to the value of the things that you create when you create the pollution. At bottom, that model is saying that the economy is the larger thing, that environmental values are a subset of economic values. How does an economist know that nature has value? Because people will pay to experience it, which makes nature an economic value and says the economy is the larger, all-encompassing thing. In fact, we should reverse that relationship and see that that economic activity is one subset of human activity. It isn't even the whole shebang. We've got all kinds of family and social activities that are not specifically economically rational. So the economy is a subset of human social action, and human social action is one subset of all kinds of interactions and relationships on the planet. So that begins to get the relationship right. And when you get that relationship right, you can see that, the larger the economy is, the less room there is for its supporting natural infrastructure, for its home base on the planet. It's possible for an economy that's a subset of nature to grow too large for the set it's subsumed in. But if you think that the economy is larger than nature, then the solution to environmental problems is more economic activity. Climate change? Well, global warming? Maybe what we need to do is invent space shades and shoot them up there with rockets, and it'll cost a lot of money, and GDP will go up, but we will shade the planet so it won't be too warm. Or, a variety of other crackpot schemes that try to come up with that try to fix environmental problems by doing more economic stuff.
Yeah, this reminds me of something my father used to say, which was like, if they would just give a complete and total 100% tax break to anyone who comes up with an answer to the energy crisis, somebody would come up with something, and it's like, they're just not trying hard enough.
I don't think that's true. I think I would tell your father over dinner, have you ever heard of the second law of thermodynamics? We're just condemned to live on a planet where the amount of energy is finite.
Yeah.
It's the amount of solar energy the planet gets is considerable, but none of it really was going to waste before we got here. It was supporting ecosystems. And we can insert ourselves into that flow and extract some of it to use it, but we need to be careful about how much we take.
Okay. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the title of the book, The Other Road to Serfdom?
Oh, yeah. some people to whom I showed the manuscript after it had been accepted and was on its way to the printer said, interesting book. You ought to change the title. It's like, Bruce, it's too late.
It's a reaction to another theorist.
Yeah, it's meant to be an in-your-face to this book, much beloved of the neoconservative movement, The Road to Serfdom. Friedrich Hayek, writing in the 40s about planning, he was reacting to the wartime planning that had happened in Britain that a lot of people became enamored of. It's like, Okay, we had central administration of prices through a price regime, and we had central administration of where resources went because we had to build tanks. No one starved. Everyone did this together, and there was no big disparity of wealth and wealthy and poor. That was not a bad system. Let's keep some elements of that after the war when we stop making tanks and planes and start making cars and stoves again. And Hayek thought that would be horrible, and he wrote the book The Road to Serfdom to halt what he saw as a nearly irresistible movement towards centralized planning of economies the way the Soviets were doing and the way, frankly, the Allies had done in order to match armament production from the Axis powers. Well, so his argument was that if you begin allocating resources at the macroeconomic level, the overall level, deciding more of this, less of that, more tanks, fewer cars, okay, in wartime, but to say afterwards, after war, more education, fewer luxury watches. No. The market should make this decision, not bureaucrats, because bureaucrats tend to want more and more power, and the impetus behind any sort of control is to control more, and it's a slippery slope down the road to serfdom, like you were seeing in the 40s and early 50s in Russia, well, most of the 50s and 60s and 70s, just to be fair. So that was what he was writing against. My argument in The Other Road to Serfdom is to say, basically, well, suppose you're right that planning is a slippery slope to more and more government control, like planning the economy. Well, then, it turns out that infinite planet thinking and free markets built on those principles are just the other road to serfdom, because we build out to the edge of what's ecologically possible, feasible, sustainable, and we need technocrats to tell us, no, there's a limit there. Lake Champlain is suffering because we exceed its total maximum daily load in phosphates. This is why there are algal blooms there. The Clean Water Act passed under Nixon calls for the calculation of the total maximum daily load of every type of relevant pollutant for waterways that have been judged impaired, and a judgment of impairment is too dirty to use for the things that people nearby want to use it for, like swim in, fishing,
bathing, drinking.
Well, the idea that there's a total maximum daily load for pollutants, that there's a burden that the stream can absorb and not be damaged, and beyond that, you're going to crash the ecosystem, this is at once a scientific idea and a limit. And if, in fact, planning an economy so that those limits aren't violated is the road to serfdom, then it turns out that the free market under infinite growth principles is just the other road to the kind of technocracy that Hayek was writing against. So I want to show in the book that there's another path, and that's the path towards sustainable democracy, which is to frankly employ policies that economic policies, political policies based in economic reality, which is the planet is finite, a carbon tax, a tax on natural resource throughput instead of on wealth, on labor. This is called the green tax shift. Labor's a good thing. We shouldn't tax it. We want people to work. So why should we tax it? Using up scarce resources is a bad thing. If we put a tax on resource extraction at the wellhead, at the mine shaft, wherever it happens, that price would be bumped along, and things that required more resources would be more expensive, and so the more sustainable option would automatically be less expensive in the marketplace.
And would become preferable to industry.
Right. And now, people like you and I, and I'm sure many of your listeners, try to replicate. We do what I think of as if purchasing. We try to replicate what a green tax structure would do by collecting information and choosing sometimes the more expensive thing because it's shade grown, organically farmed, done sustainably, done local. We're willing to pay a premium for that but we need to collect the information in order to make the right choices. If there were an extraction tax, a throughput tax, a carbon tax, if there were these kinds of taxes, the decision would be easy. It's like, oh, this costs more. That must be less sustainable. This is cheaper. And I say, you know, these are taxes that I would like to see imposed, but it could be done in a revenue neutral way. That is, I'm not saying let's grow government and have more and more taxes. Let's cut the income tax. Let's get rid of the income tax. I don't care how much money you have. It's the extraction of stuff from nature that ought to be taxed, not the amount of work you do.
Okay, great. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that you have written a novel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. In the 90s, you wrote a novel called Panama, which was a bestseller and a New York Times notable book. The novel concerns the attempts of the French to build the Panama Canal. So I wondered how you became interested in this period in history, and I also wondered if you still ever write fiction.
Oh, I'm thinking about another novel as not quite my next book, but the one after that. There's sort of this imaginary queue, like, okay, this book, and then that book, and then that.
So, two How books. Many down is it?
Right.
Two down?
Two.
Okay.
Two out there. How I came to write that? Well, you know, looking back, I guess I always was a writer because I had a particular relationship to words. Words had power, words on a page. I was more inclined to want to communicate precisely on paper than orally. I was kind of shy. Hard to believe. Shy and inarticulate at one point. And after I finished my dissertation, I thought, you know, I don't want to write anything with footnotes. It's like, you know, you're typing along and then you have to stop. And this was the olden days. You had to stop, go find the book, look up the page, write down the publisher, do all that stuff right there, because you were going to forget it if you didn't do it. And it really interrupts the flow and makes everything take longer. And so I started writing essays that were on environmental themes. And those were collected and published after the novel. But I was publishing them in the North American Review, these environmental essays. My ambition was to join the great American tradition of wisdom literature, Nietzsche writing, you know, Thoreau, Berry, me. but I thought I had an angle, a take that wasn't out there much, and that was this background in political philosophy. So I wrote about some of the stuff that I care about in essays that had some literary merit, I guess, where I took trouble to shape them and make them literary works. When I had enough, I started asking various people about publishing them, and one of the answers I heard was, oh my God, essays, nobody reads them, so no one publishes them. You want to get published? Write a novel.
Really? Wow.
I was like, oh, I could do that, I guess. And, at that point, I was getting so I really wanted to have a book out there. So I started writing this book. Takes me a while to remember. I had it in mind to work up a plot in which I was very intrigued with the idea that we become what we hate, and pick your enemies carefully because there's some way that you come to mirror them. And having studied American national security policy in graduate school, I was ready to write about a renegade group of generals this is part of the dynamic that actually happened between the U.S. and the USSR, was the American military would exaggerate the threat of the USSR to justify more and more weapons programs. And it didn't take but a slight twist of imagination to think, well, as information flows become more accurate, the generals would not be the only source of information about the military strength of the USSR. So what if a group of generals decided to actually transfer high technology weapons to the USSR so that they could justify their own desire to have more and to have research programs that continued. So I was working on a plot where some American generals trade missiles to the enemy. Iran-Contra.
I know, right? Reagan did that.
Right. If I had managed to get the book written in a fortnight and published. But as Iran-Contra was sort of then happening, and I thought, okay, this plot now looks like I didn't imagine it. I'm just transforming it. And I happened at that moment to stumble on David McCullough's great book about the Panama Canal. And he devotes fully a third of this book, The Path Between the Seas, to the French experience. Oh, and it had everything a novelist could want. Particularly one who wants to ride some hobby horse ponies into the story. One of the reasons the French failed is just that the technology wasn't sufficient to dominate nature. And there was a kind of arrogance. The Frenchman who was the head of the work in Panama, Ferdinand de Lesseps, had successfully built, engineered the canal at Suez. Mm-hmm. He was no kind of engineer. He was just sort of a romantic, entrepreneurial, self-romanticizing kind of guy. He gave his occupation on his passport as canal builder. And he instigated the French Interoceanic Canal Company. And as far as route surveys went, he looked at a map of Panama and said, put it there. That was it. If they had done the work they had done on a path that was more commodious, they might have actually succeeded. If they had built a canal with locks, his intention was a sea level canal through the thinnest part, which just happened to be through a part of the mountains where the underlying geology was such that every time you took a scoop out, two scoops fell into the ravine, the ditch. This was the hardest work on the canal, and it bedeviled the Americans when they got there. Well, the idea that there was a failed technological effort to dominate nature at the heart of this story had some appeal to me.
Yeah.
And it had everything else you could want. Murder, intrigue, suspense, international political importance with the canal negotiations. And so I decided to thread a story through those facts. My huge moment of insight, the thing that got me really excited about the book, was when I realized, oh, the American historian Henry Adams, about whom I had written in my dissertation, he was in France back then. Oh, it would be so interesting to turn him into a detective.
That's who you wrote your dissertation on?
Dissertation was about... my dissertation was a kind of social history of the second law of thermodynamics.
Oh, okay.
Which Henry Adams tripped over and used to great effect in some of his writing. Like, oh, everything's on a path downhill, just to oversimplify.
So you knew his work.
I knew his work. Yeah. And knew that that one of the defining moments of his life was his wife's suicide. Mm. And also knew that his life's work included, he wrote a multi-volume history of the United States, 9 volumes about 2 presidential administrations, Jefferson and Madison. It took him almost as long to write as the period he was writing about. Just comprehensive, fat history. He published nothing for a while, and his next book was what some critics have called a long prose poem, Mont-Saint-Michel and Chartres, which is about, takes as its project, here are 2 cathedrals begun scarcely 100 years apart, and they couldn't be more different. Mont-Saint-Michel and Chartres, one dedicated to the Archangel Michael, one dedicated to the Virgin. What happened to explain this difference in stone? And his book goes into, some part is about the literal differences in stone, the vaulting that allowed the windows to be larger and the ceilings higher, but some is about the difference in theology, the changes in the church. The Song of Roland is recounted in there at one point because it's relevant to how he's doing the story. And the whole thing manages to be very learned, but also very intimate. He presents it as a book for not his nieces, but his nieces in wish, which he says is like, he saw himself in this avuncular role of everybody's favorite uncle, even to people he wasn't related to. So I thought he would make a very interesting detective, somebody who's got all this thinking going on and sometimes doesn't see stuff in front of him. One reviewer compared him to a kind of Mr. Magoo, which I thought, okay, that gets it. But also, you know, there's some, I hit some of the standard tropes of detective fiction. The detective has to have something on the line. His life has to be threatened. You know, he has to be strongly motivated to puzzle out the puzzle, which, you know, he gets somewhere, but he doesn't solve the whole thing, which I thought was also kind of modernist, you know? So I had, I say great fun writing it. After it was done and published, I sort of missed the daily visit with Henry Adams and what he was doing. So I might go back to him in another novel.
To him? Somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Cool. When that book was published, someone wrote me a fan letter saying, oh, I hope this is the start of a whole series of Henry Adams detective stories. And I was like, geez, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I got these other projects in mind.
So every 20 years, like clockwork.
But now I think, what would be the harm of, I'm going to slide into retirement writing detective fiction based on...
Yeah, well, the book was very well received. People loved it. I was just reading about it. All right. What are you working on now?
Oh. Well, I've been writing essays for the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. They have a blog post called The Daily News, D-A-L-Y, named for Herman Daly. And I do occasional, I'm one of the regular contributors.
Okay.
I should be working on, and haven't been working on so much this summer, a book that's under contract to Springer called The Master Resource, which is going to be a history of our thinking about energy, which is, I'm going to go back to my dissertation and you know, harvest some of that stuff I did way back when, because thinking about thermodynamics, I mean, I was telling the history of the laws of thermodynamics and their effect on other things. Part of that was telling a little bit of the history of our energy use. So Energy as Master Resource will be an account of how we've thought about energy and how economics needs to be transformed to think about it better.
Right.
The editor was in the audience when I gave a talk that's actually a YouTube talk, keynote address at the fourth annual conference of the Biophysical Economics Association, a keynote talk I gave. The editor of a series for Springer was in the audience and talked to me about turning it into a book, and I thought I would have finished by now, but I haven't been working on it as perspicaciously as I should. How often do you get to use that word?
I know, it's a great word. I love that word.
Yeah, so that's probably next, and then after that, I think I am ready to come back to Henry Adams, unless someone dangles some money in front of me and says, oh, do a follow-up to this, that, or the other thing, so who knows, but that's current intention.
Okay.
And in terms of the essays I'm doing, I'm continuing to try to apply the concepts and categories of this alternative economic vision to current events, and to support those who are working in that general area. My most recent essay for the Daily News was one on Vermont's use of the Genuine Progress Indicator, the GPI. And it's called Transformative Common Sense in Vermont. The idea being the Genuine Progress Indicator is a common sense alternative to GDP. GDP measures how fast we make the money go around. Doesn't measure well-being, economic well-being. Doesn't measure net economic product. It's gross domestic product.
Mm-hmm.
Most businessmen know that to get your net, you have to subtract the costs from your gross. We just count the gross. We don't subtract the costs. GPI subtracts environmental costs from GDP, and among other, it makes 26 separate adjustments to a basic figure for GDP. So GPI is a much better measure of our economic activity. And Vermont officially adopted the GPI as a metric, or officially authorized us at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. They officially authorized us to compile it and give it to them, and said that they were going to, the legislation says, for use in budgeting, program evaluation, and strategic planning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the GPI just got written into the state's comprehensive economic development strategy, which is, I think, huge.
That's, yeah.
I started the essay by saying, you know, if someone said to you, comprehensive economic development strategy, you wouldn't think revolution. But there's a change afoot here. Quiet revolution. I call it transformative common sense. It's just common sense. You have to deduct costs from benefits. But it's weird that such a commonsensical idea would be so subversive of the existing order of things, or so transformative.
Yeah.
So I wrote an update kind of on GPI work. I've written about GPI stuff a few times.
Have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners, either nonfiction or fiction or whatever you might have been enjoying lately?
What I'm reading now, I'm actually reading for school, Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, and I'm enjoying that. I read very much of, most of Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is also a book assigned to the students in a class I'm going to teach. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick the book list, so I've spent some of my summer reading the book list. And I found much of value in both books. And yet, it turns out they're not beach reading. I had them at the beach, and it's like, this is not what I want to read here. So what I did want to read was an old Scott Turow novel, you know, in terms of books that I really have been enjoying, I'm reading The Summer Book by Tove Johansson. And Out Stealing Horses was a great book.
Oh, that's a great book.
And so was David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, and they've both been out there a while. In terms of my field, stuff that's out recently, I've been reading essays online and not so much, that seems to be the coin of the realm, not so much book form. Mm-hmm. There was just a long essay. It's about degrowth, the idea that in order to fit the economy to the planet, we have, the Western societies especially, have to degrow. And it was about how that might happen, like what sorts of policies, what sorts of measurements we might need. And it would be a hard task, but, you know, sometimes the truth is hard.
Yeah.
Like, our economy is too big for the planet.
Right.
What are we going to do about it? Pretend that's not true?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for asking me to. This has been great fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview from 2014 with Vermont author Eric Zensi, who died on July 1st after a battle with prostate cancer. You can learn more about Eric's life and work, as well as the Eric Zensi Prize in Ecological Economics, by searching for Eric Zensi on the Gund Institute's website, uvm.edu/Gund. And actually, I think they have part of that page devoted to Eric right now. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider the following quote from Eric Zensi's book, The Other Road to Serfdom and the Path to Sustainable Democracy. Consider this passage and then write about whatever might occur to you after having read it. In a world where significant numbers of people experience food insecurity or outright starvation, a nation rich enough to be well-fed, rich enough to command food resources from other regions, is likely to become a target of envy, anger, censure, and resentment. When those emotions find political expression, wealthy nations and their citizens become literal targets of riots and protests abroad and of low-budget terrorist violence against their people and property wherever they're most vulnerable. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I don't know if you heard the announcement, but the 2019 Vermont Book Award finalists were announced this week, and I'm going to announce them to you here as well because it's exciting. There are 10 finalists, and this is actually a mix of genres, but anyway, The Season of Styx Malone by Kekla Magoon, A Stitch in Time by Daphne Kalmar, Drunk in the Woods by former Write the Book guest Tony Whedon, and Tony's going to be on the show again soon to talk about Drunk in the Woods. That's happening this summer, I think. The Animal 1,000 Miles Long, Seven Lengths of Vermont and Other Adventures by Leif Tonino. My Bishop and Other Poems by Michael Collier, also a former Write the Book guest. Age of Glass by Anna Marie Hong. Box by Sue D. Burton. Berlin by Jason Lutz. The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. And H&G by Anna Marie Hong. It's the first time the Vermont Book Award has had two particular finalists be the same person for two different works. The winner of the Vermont Book Award for 2019 will be announced at a gala in November at the college. I will keep you posted about that. We're kind of short on time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, but it will return next week after I speak with Vermont author Susan Ritz about her debut novel, A Dream to Die For, which launches this week. There will be a live interview. That will be a live interview in the studio, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm still doing my book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books you've heard about on this show, you may go to my website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Use the contact tab to ask me for my copy of that book. If you are the first to ask and you live in an area with U.S. domestic postal rates, I will send it to you. I also have a new tab on the website, which is labeled hashtag book giveaway, where you can see photos of the books I still have. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, do let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available at writethebook.podbean.com and on iTunes, Spotify, and other places where podcasts are found. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or a book that you'd like to hear the author interviewed, or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, do please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all of your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.